The wages of whiteness seemed to be good enough for a majority of the workers eligible to vote at the Nissan plant, a group that excluded the most precarious and disproportionately black temporary workers. As difficult as it was for me to put myself in the shoes of an anti-union white factory worker, in order to truly understand what had happened to the American working class, I had to try. Perhaps, when it comes down to it, I wrote in my notebook, the being matters more than the having. Often, what we have, a nice house, cash in the bank, a good car, is a simple way of telling ourselves and others who we are. Work and our rewards for it are the means. The end is, above a certain level of subsistence, our sense of self-esteem. So perhaps, to a white person facing this trade-off, some tangible financial benefits are easy to give up if you already have what money buys in our society, which is belonging and status. White people today, particularly outside the South, often distance themselves from slavery and Jim Crow by insisting that their immigrant ancestors had nothing to do with these atrocities and, in fact, themselves faced discrimination but were able to overcome it. In fact, this popular belief is one of the core ideas contributing to white racial resentment against black people and newer immigrants of color. But the Irish, Germans, Poles, Slavs, Russians, Italians, and other Europeans who came to the United States underwent a process of attaining whiteness, an identity created in contrast to the blackness of unfree and degraded labor. As immigrants, these groups had an opportunity to ally themselves with abolition and, later, equal rights, and to fight for better social and economic conditions for all workers. They chose instead, with few exceptions, the wages of whiteness. Irish immigrants present a clear example. Upon the first wave of immigration in the 1820s, the jobs and even neighborhoods the Irish had access to were full of black people, enslaved or just barely not. As ditch diggers in the expanding Deep South, domestic servants, dock workers, and livery drivers, the Irish were thrown into a labor pool where they worked shoulder to shoulder with black people. One of the most influential Irish nationalist leaders of the 1830s and 40s, Daniel O'Connell, was an abolitionist who railed against slavery and the exploitation of all workers. He saw that any society that treated some workers in that way would always abuse others. But the zero-sum story proved too powerful. Every day, Irish immigrants heard from employers that they would hire either Irish or black workers for the most menial and labor-intensive jobs, whichever group they could pay the least. They heard the zero-sum from Democratic Party leaders, whose strategy was twofold: become the anti-black, pro-slavery foil to the Republicans, and recruit Irish men as voters in large cities. Think about it. If you came to a country and saw the class of people in power abusing another group, and your place in relation to both groups was uncertain, wouldn't you want to align yourself with the powerful group? And wouldn't you be tempted to abuse the other to show your allegiance? As they fought to be considered more white than black, Irish people gained a reputation in black neighborhoods as brutal enforcers of the racial hierarchy, attacking those beneath them to ensure their place. Irish attacks on blacks became so common in New York City that bricks were known as Irish confetti, wrote historian Michael Miller Topp. In the Civil War draft riots that took place in New York City over 4 days in July 1863, more than 1,000 Irish immigrants in mobs attacked the black community, including children, in an orphanage. They caused so much carnage and terror that the black population of New York decreased by 20% afterward. The logic of the massacre, as much as one can find logic in mass atrocity, was the zero sum. The Irish rioters didn't want to go fight in a war that might free millions of black workers to come north and compete for their jobs. David Roediger, a history and African American studies professor at the University of Kansas, wrote the books The Wages of Whiteness and Working Toward Whiteness: How America's Immigrants Became White, which recount the process by which European immigrants were sold membership to the top category of a racial caste system. The price they paid was acquiescence to an economic caste system. Immigrants who were able to attain whiteness got the voting rights, even before becoming citizens in many places, including New York City, jobs, and education that American citizenship offered. Even as they struggled with the exploitation of sweatshops and slums, becoming white afforded them a civic and social esteem that could constantly be compared against the black second-class citizens one rung below them. Roediger uses the term Herrenvolk Republicanism to describe American society as a representative democracy only for those considered, like Aryans under Nazism, to be part of the master race. In his words, Herrenvolk Republicanism had the advantage of reassuring whites in a society in which downward mobility was a constant fear. One might lose everything, but not whiteness. In order to keep what Du Bois called a psychological wage, white workers needed not to contest too strongly for more material wages. To fight for a fairer system, the working class would have needed collective action, which has always been in tension with the pull of American racism. I was on the phone one afternoon with Robin DiAngelo, the white writer who coined the expression white fragility, when she took a personal digression from the topic we were discussing. DiAngelo and her two sisters were raised in poverty by their single mom. "She was not able to feed, house, or clothe us," DiAngelo recalled. "I mean, we were flat out. We lived in our car. We were not bathed. My mother could not take care of us. And yet, anything I ever wanted to touch, like food someone left out, I was hungry, right? I was reprimanded. 'Don't touch that. You don't know who touched it. It could have been a colored person.' 'Don't sit there. You don't know who sat there. It could have been a colored person.'" That was the language. This was the 60s. The message was clear. If a colored person touched it, it would be dirty. But I was dirty. Yet in those moments, the shame of poverty was lifted. I wasn't poor anymore. I was white. Robin's story called to mind a study co-authored by Michael Norton, one of the professors who identified the increasingly zero-sum mindset among white people. Norton and his colleagues would call the psychology behind DiAngelo's mother's warnings last-place aversion. In a hierarchical system like the American economy, people often show more concern about their relative position in the hierarchy than their absolute status. Norton and his colleagues used games where they gave participants the option to give money to either people who had more money than they had or those who had less. In general, people gave money to those who had less, except for people who were in the second-to-last place in the money distribution to begin with. These players more often gave their money to the people above them in the distribution so that they wouldn't fall into last place themselves. The study authors also looked at real-world behaviors and found that lower-income people are less supportive of redistributive policies that would help them than logic would suggest. Even though raising the minimum wage is overwhelmingly popular, people who make a dollar above the current minimum, and thus those most likely to drop into last place alongside the workers at the bottom, expressed less support. Last-place aversion suggests that low-income individuals might oppose redistribution because they fear it might differentially help a last-place group to whom they can currently feel superior, the study authors wrote. That superior feeling, however, doesn't fill your stomach, as DiAngelo learned as a child. The stories I heard on the ground in Mississippi painted a picture of an economic pessimism that sapped the aspirations of most workers, white and black. The Nissan job was one of the best in the state, and the company threatened that with a union, the plant would disappear. Workers heard this messaging 24/7 on video screens inside the plant, on leaflets paid for by the Koch brothers, left in mailboxes at their homes, and in every statewide politician's talking points on the radio and local news. One of the most successful threats was that with a yes union vote, Nissan would repossess the company cars that many workers had leased. No matter that a union would have given workers a say in this and all other benefits, the threat of your wife or mama's car going missing was scary enough for some, Melvin told me with a sigh. I thought about how, in addition to the legacy of centuries of racist programming, white anti-union workers were also dealing with at least 40 years of economic programming that told them that the best days for unions and for the middle class were behind them, and that everyone was on their own to grab what they could from a dwindling pie. On my last morning in Canton, I had breakfast in my hotel's lobby with Chip Wells, the man who'd become a controversial figure at the plant in the final weeks before the election. He had been an outspoken white voice on the pro-union organizing committee, so much so that he became the target of intimidation from anti-union people at the plant. He showed me a snapshot on his phone of his employee ID photo printed out as a poster in the security guard's room. Someone had drawn a teardrop tattoo on his left cheek and some kind of cross or swastika on his forehead. One of the people he worked alongside in the generally anti-union maintenance department, one of the better paid departments, began to joke about Chip getting hurt or fallen. Eventually, Chip said he thought, maybe he ain't joking, you know, because he's from Natchez and that's where they actually had slave auction blocks and stuff. The pressure eventually got to him, and at a rally one Sunday, Chip donned an anti-union shirt, signaling to the cheers of white workers around him that he had switched sides. Chip told me that during the time he was anti, as they called it, he was struck by the zero-sum mindset of the people on his team. The idea is that if you uplift black people, you're down in white people. It's like the world has a crab-in-a-barrel mentality. Every time somebody's getting on top, we gotta pull them down because they might try to do us wrong or keep us down. White workers who supported the union, like Trent and Johnny, told me that their view was different from that of most of their white peers because they saw their interests as the same as those of the black workers. In their telling, everybody would benefit from better health care, plant safety, pay raises, job security, retirement benefits, and a fair system for promotions to replace what they call the buddy-buddy system, where who you hunt with matters more than your work ethic. With the yes-no black-white divide so stark, I wanted to know how a black pro-union worker would approach a white worker on the opposite side. Melvin broke it down for me. You find out what you have in common, that common ground. And whenever you're tired and they're tired, it's the same. We bleed the same. We get tired the same. We sweat the same. When it's hot, you hot. You just find out that common ground. And that's how we reach the white workers. Some you may not ever reach. Some, they look at me and they just look at you like you a nigga, no matter what. And this union organizing stuff, we have to be some of the most insane people. Because you take even the most racist, the most hateful people, and you're willing to put your job on the line to fight for them, you understand? We have to be losing our minds. So it doesn't matter. The ones that hate you the most are the ones that you fight for the most. And you care about them the most. You keep them close to you. You keep them close to you. But this is how you deal with your white coworkers. They're people too. Hey, look, they got kids. You got kids. Y'all just find that common ground. When Melvin finished speaking, there were plenty of nods around the room at the worker center, but Earl was less confident that white folks wanted to share any kind of ground with him. If we all have better pay and better benefits, maybe now I can buy a house in Deerfield, a white enclave in their area, he said, eyebrows arched. Maybe. I would move in next to an Ole Miss law grad, and Saturday morning when he comes out to get his paper, I'd be there watering my lawn. Maybe I'll be able to demand better education for our kids. Earl knew the exact amount by which the governor had cut the education budget in the most recent session, mentioning it multiple times. The governor just cut $5.3 million from the education budget. The union could have fought that in the state house. The guys at the worker center wanted me to know that the problems didn't stop at the factory door. They felt that nobody had a long-term commitment to the state, not the company, not the politicians. They thought a lot about what would happen to the workers after their bodies inevitably wore down. Folks will need disability, but the governor moves to cut that, make it harder to get on disability. That drives the whole state down, said Trent. They told me about the favors Nissan got in the state house including hundreds of millions in tax breaks at a time when the state's schools are chronically underfunded. In order to appease the community, Nissan made donations in lieu of taxes to local schools, but the worker group saw that as a sham as well. The company gets to decide where those voluntary school payments get made, and they end up directed to the districts where the upper management's kids go. Earl connected the dots. You don't need someone to be educated if you want them to work menial jobs and feel lucky for doing it. It goes hand in hand with the goals of Nissan. At the end of a long week in Mississippi, I boarded a small regional plane out of the state. As I sat looking over my notes, a grief I'd held at bay during all my conversations with those extraordinary everyday people grabbed at me. What they wanted for themselves, their children, and their community, what they wanted even for the people in the plant who despised them, was a little more say over the decisions that shaped their lives. And they'd been defeated by a powerful, profitable corporation and the very old zero-sum story. But there's another story woven through the history of worker struggle in America, of people refusing to fight alone and winning the solidarity dividend of better jobs despite the odds. Over the past decade, that story gained a new chapter, written by some of the least likely, lowest-paid workers in our economy. The movement began on November 29, 2012, when about 200 fast food workers rallied just outside Times Square in the heart of Manhattan. They were hourly workers at the bottom of the pay scale, almost all brown and black, mostly young adults, often with children. They worked at Burger King, McDonald's, Subway, and Sparrow. But they had either walked off the job or not gone in at all in order to attend an unprecedented one-day strike across the city. They chanted slogans like, 1, 2, 3, 4, time for you to pay more. 5, 6, 7, 8, don't you dare retaliate. Without a union's protection, they could have been fired upon their return to work, but they gained courage in numbers. Their demand? A raise from the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour and a union. It was audacious. I'll count myself among the gobsmacked. My Demos colleagues and I had been pressing the case to raise the minimum wage for years, using research and advocacy to argue that a poverty wage that hadn't kept up with rising costs was contributing to economic inequality, rising debt, and bankruptcies. But the consensus advocacy goal had been a raise to $10.10, and even that modest an increase had gone precisely nowhere. Little press attention, no big rallies, unsigned bills languishing in state houses and congressional committees. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, a new, game-changing goal appeared that said to some of the country's poorest workers, "This could change your life." Within a year, what would become the Fight for 15 had spread across the country. Everyday workers gained the courage to demand more with the organizing support of local anti-poverty community organizers and the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU. Many workers credited the 2011 Occupy Wall Street movement for raising their consciousness about the unfairness of working in poverty for profitable corporations. And in fact, fast food was the most unequal industry in the economy. Demos research calculated an over 1,000-to-1 average CEO-to-worker pay gap. Then, in November 2013, the impossible happened. A $15 an hour victory, won by airport baggage handlers, jet fuelers, food vendors, and wheelchair attendants. These were subcontractors at the Seattle area SeaTac Airport, making around $9.70 an hour, a poverty wage for the Seattle area. The diversity was wide-ranging. Black Americans, white Americans, immigrants from Greece, Uzbekistan, Haiti, Vietnam, Somalia, the Philippines, and elsewhere. While the non-citizen-citizen divide could have been an opening for a divide-and-conquer strategy, the organizers focused on training immigrants in their rights and teaching them the broader story of income inequality in America, a story that was reinforced by the native-born workers. Veteran employees could recall when their airport service jobs had been decent ones, just a decade before. But with sudden deregulation and subcontracting, almost overnight, the pay and conditions for the exact same work had plummeted. This sudden change, and its clear origin in management decisions, made it easier for workers to place the blame on the companies that abruptly changed the rules to squeeze more profit, not on the new immigrant workers. The multi-hued group of activists, supported by the local SEIU and Seattle area community groups, won a ballot initiative in the airport town, SeaTac, to raise airport worker wages to $15. The margin of victory was just 77 votes. Sensing momentum, however, the coalition of supporters made a wild bet that they could win in an even bigger fight in Seattle itself. By that time, in the spring of 2013, Seattle fast food workers of every color were walking out in one-day strikes and organizing across the city. By August 29th, on a national day of action that coincided with the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the streets of 60 cities teemed with fast food workers demanding higher wages. But they weren't alone. Retail workers from department stores like Macy's and chains like Victoria's Secret also joined in. A year later, the demonstrations would include adjunct professors with graduate degrees. By May 2014, the Seattle City Council voted to make theirs the first American city to raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour. Terrence Wise never thought that this would be his life at age 40. It's not that he was surprised to be working in fast food. His mother raised him on a Hardee's paycheck. So he grew up knowing that big chain restaurants offered hard but honest and always available work. Too many family bills to juggle caused Terrence to drop out of high school to work full-time, and in the 20 years since, he'd barely seen a raise. Even though he worked so many hours that he was always missing his three daughters, he hadn't been able to avoid a spell of homelessness. All that, though depressing, seemed pretty much the norm in America. What Terrence never expected, though, was that he'd find himself in the leadership of a global movement, speaking at the White House and testifying before the U.S. Congress. Though he'd been an honors track student and won awards for public speaking in high school, all that promise was far from his mind on the Sunday in 2012 when three people, two black, one white, walked into his Burger King and asked him to imagine more. It was a Domino's worker, McDonald's worker, and a Subway worker, Terrence recalled to me with a smile in his voice. The three workers asked him, "Do you think fast food workers should earn a living wage, vacation, and health benefits?" Well, I hadn't seen a doctor. At that point, it'd been years, over a decade. So, yeah, he recalls telling the workers. "We deserve the opportunity for benefits, paid time off, sick days, things that we don't have." They told him that they were organizing their fellow fast food workers across the city. Terrence told them to count him in, and by the end of the day, he had signed up the six co-workers on his shift to join Stand Up KC, or Kansas City, a group that would eventually join in the national fight for 15. Terrence got his first taste of collective action's power when he and his co-workers wrote up a petition and confronted the supervisor to demand simple safety improvements. Stock up the first aid kit, fix the broken wheels on the grease trap, replace the hoses that were leaking hot grease. Just simple things that we know billion-dollar corporations like McDonald's, Burger King can afford. And it worked. The first time he went out on a one-day walkout protest from his job at Burger King, he came back and his boss gave him a dollar or so raise when he'd been refusing for years. "So I've seen the power of coming together and organizing and how it can make change. And I've definitely lived the life of when we were not organized and how life just deteriorated over the years." Part of what had kept the fast food workers in Kansas City unorganized was a racial and cultural divide. Historically, one of the country's most segregated cities along lines of black and white, Kansas City had also seen an increase in the Latino population in the late 1990s after NAFTA. Workers of different cultures didn't communicate much. Language was a barrier in some instances, and there were rumors that Latino managers were giving Latino workers higher pay and sick days. Getting workers out of the stores, into each other's homes, and sharing their stories helped dispel these myths. From the beginning, Stand Up KC named racism as a common enemy. Its first printed banner read, "United Against Racism, Good Jobs for All." The message has resonated with Terrence. We've got to build a multiracial movement, a different kind of social justice movement for the 21st century. And we've got to talk about it, multiracial organizing and how to build the movement, you know? We've got to have a new vision for America. We're building the Fight for 15 and a union movement, and we've got to have a new identity for the working class. What do we do every day in this country? All of us get up and go to work. We make this country run. And now, more than ever, workers are producing more wealth than we've received, you know? We're being exploited across the board, he told me over the phone, and I could just picture him bringing a crowd to its feet. Many of the signs that workers carried in their Stand Up KC rallies and strikes made it clear that cross-racial solidarity was the point. "Racial unity now, we won't fight each other," read one sign. "Black, white, brown, we fight wage slavery and racial division," read another. And another, "Black, white, brown, defeat McPoverty, defeat hate." I thought back to Canton. The UAW's message about race had invoked civil rights for black workers, but the fast food message explicitly included white people in the coalition and named division, not just racial oppression, as a common enemy. That story helped transform the way Bridget Hughes saw the world. Bridget is a white woman whose Irish ancestry shows up in her reddish hair and whose Missouri accent is slight but unmistakable to those who know how to listen for it. She has three children and has worked in fast food for over a decade. Like Terrence, she was an honor student with college potential, but she had to drop out to support her family when her mother got sick. When Bridget was first approached by a coworker at Wendy's about joining Stand Up KC, she was skeptical, to say the least. "I didn't think things in my life would ever change. They weren't going to give $15 an hour to a fast food worker. That was just insane to me." But she went to the first meeting anyway. When a Latinx woman rose and described her life, three children in a two-bedroom apartment with plumbing issues, the feeling of being trapped in a life where she didn't have any opportunity to do anything better, Bridget was moved. I was really able to see myself in her. And at that point, I decided that the only way we was going to fix it was if all of us came together. Whether we were white, brown, black, it didn't matter. For Bridget, to see herself in a Latinx worker was a breakthrough. She admitted, "When I first joined the movement, I had been fed this whole line of, these immigrant workers are coming over here and stealing our jobs, not paying taxes, committing crimes, and causing problems." It was other white people in my family who believed these kinds of racist ideas, you know, us against them. But she said she saw her bosses at Wendy's target Latinx workers, falsely promising them a raise if they didn't join the strikes. They knew that if our Latino workers joined with our black and white workers, that we'd have our strength in numbers and that we was going to win. Since joining Stand Up KC, Bridget's worldview has changed. "In order for all of us to come up, it's not a matter of me coming up and them staying down. It's a matter of, in order for me to come up, they have to come up too, because we have to come up together. Because honestly, as long as we're divided, we're conquered. The only way that we're going to succeed is together." And they did succeed. Stand Up KC lobbied the city council to raise the local minimum wage to $13 an hour. Almost immediately, the Republican state legislature passed a law forbidding any municipality from requiring a wage higher than the state's $7.70, a move that would be replicated by Republican legislatures across the country. As I got to know more of the workers and leaders in the Fight for 15, it became clear to me that they had thought through their racial analysis. In their protest signs, speeches, and demands, they weren't just talking about class issues while tacking on comments about racial pay disparities. They were explicitly saying that overcoming racism was crucial to their class-based goal. They understood that black workers would likely be their most dedicated base of organizers. Indeed, the Fight for 15's first two national days of action were set to commemorate anniversaries of the civil rights movement. And in the early days, many chapters cross-organized with Black Lives Matter activists, recognizing that the people who were active against police brutality were often working in fast food and retail by day. The stakes of raising pay were explicitly racial in Birmingham, Alabama in 2016. The mostly black city government dared to raise the minimum wage for work within the city limits to $10.10 an hour to escape what city officials and activists called the Jim Crow economy. In response, the mostly white state legislature quickly voted to block the pay raise from going into effect. The advocates sued, and a federal court sided with the city, finding that the white state legislature had acted with racial animus against the black city government. Birmingham wasn't wrong to say that making people work for so little that they can't meet their needs is redolent of the Jim Crow economic order. The 21 states that have kept their minimum wages at the lowest possible level, $7.25, have some of the largest African American populations in the country. Most people of color are operating in a poverty wage economy. Nationwide, the majority of African Americans and Latinos earn less than $15 an hour. But white people are still suffering from that same economy and in great numbers. While only a third of white workers earn less than $15 an hour, they are still the majority of under $15 an hour workers, and thus will be the largest group to benefit from the organizing spearheaded by workers of color. This fight for decent pay has, like many labor struggles before it, exposed the fact that workers of color suffer the most acute economic injustices, but most of the people harmed in a wage structure built on racism are white. And like every truly successful labor movement, it has found its reach and its strength because of cross-racial solidarity. What distinguished the auto workers' organizing drive from the fast food campaign? Both were explicit about the racial dynamics at play, both invoked the civil rights struggle, and both had black workers in leadership. But management's divide-and-conquer strategy did not work against the Fight for 15. When the movement first emerged, there were press reports and social media stories about usually white workers earning around $15, feeling that their work would be degraded if, quote, burger flippers earned just as much. Fast food work, after all, is one of the lowest status jobs in the economy. With the face of the fast food worker in early press coverage being black, I remember worrying that age-old stereotypes about the low value of black work and black life would doom the audacious campaign. But this time would be different. The multiracial American working class had shouldered deindustrialization, deunionization, the financial crisis, and the squeeze of unaffordable housing and healthcare. At a time of record corporate profits, these service workers had become the driving force of the American economy, working underpaid jobs that couldn't be outsourced and that required human touch, voice, and judgment. Those fighting for 15 undoubtedly had less to lose. The legacy Nissan workers who could vote made more than twice what fast food workers were paid and, in a way, could free ride on a wage floor lifted by decades of labor organizing in Detroit. But the campaign strategies were also different. By inviting white workers to see how the powerful profited from selling them a racist story that cost everybody, whether brown, black, or white, as workers so often said, the Fight for 15 had managed to win the support of whites as well. By almost every financial measure, the Fight for 15 has been a success, creating a solidarity dividend that reversed a trend of two generations of stagnant and declining wages for the lowest paid workers. Many of the workers who rallied on that first day in 2012 near Times Square went on to testify at the New York State Capitol in 2016, when they won a statewide $15 minimum wage. So too did workers in states including California, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., as well as cities that include Flagstaff, Arizona, the Twin Cities, and Seattle, all of which have raised or committed to raising wages to $15 an hour. In addition to these policy wins, Workers won private wage increases at giant employers including Walmart, Bank of America, McDonald's, which also announced it would stop lobbying against minimum wage increases, and Amazon. All this progress was won against the prevailing business and conservative argument that raising the minimum wage would hurt exactly the workers who went on strike across the country, and that raising it to something approaching a living wage would be catastrophic. Instead, the result has been $68 billion more in the pockets of 22 million low-paid workers. It turns out that more money in people's pockets is not just good for rich people when it comes to tax cuts, and that employers could have afforded it all along. There was no drop in employment in places with wage increases, and in fact, many places have found the opposite. The more elusive goal for the fight for 15 and a union has been the last part, the union. With high turnover and hundreds of shops per city, organizing workers restaurant by restaurant might take decades. The key to unionization of the thousands of franchises is for the law to recognize that umbrella corporations like McDonald's are joint employers with the franchise owners, as they set virtually all the terms of business. The SEIU made this case before the courts. The National Labor Relations Board agreed with them in 2015, and it looked like American fast food workers were going to join their counterparts in many European countries in having a way to bargain for higher wages and benefits. But one of the first moves from the Trump administration was to reverse the Obama NLRB decision on franchise joint employment. The majority of workers in American fast food come from the same white working-class pool of voters who went overwhelmingly for Trump, a man whose campaign was dominated by promises to fight for the white working class and punish immigrants. When I spoke with her after the 2016 election, Bridget connected Trump's election to the urgency of Stand Up KC's cross-racial organizing. Kind of the whole point of this movement is for white workers to understand that racism affects white workers as well, because it keeps us divided from our black and our brown brothers and sisters. So we need to understand that as white workers, we too need to stand up and fight against racism. As I was wrapping up my last visit to the Worker Center in Canton, Mississippi, I took the time to walk around the space. An unadorned storefront had been transformed with posters printed and hand-drawn, photos from rallies, and pictures of workers' kids. People came in for coffee and company after their overnight shifts ended at dawn, and they'd come in before work to gear up for the long shift ahead. I recalled something Chip had said that morning as I got ready to leave our breakfast. First, he wanted me to know that despite his visible defection in the last weeks, he'd stayed true when the time came. I got in that booth, and it was very liberating to vote yes. Second, even though he was afraid he wouldn't be welcome anymore at the Worker Center, he needed me to know about the solidarity he felt there. I felt a sense of belonging, of love, of togetherness, friendship, he said with emotion in his voice. We went through a lot together and did a lot together and accomplished a lot. I loved it. I loved going over there. It was, I guess, utopia. Without having utopia.